Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Elodie Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host for today is Dave Allen, and we will bring to you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. Today is Friday, January 5th, 2018. Good afternoon, Dave.
Happy Friday, Melody.
Oh, I'll tell you what. It's been such a hectic day here today, which is good at Discount Gold and Silver Trading. So This hour, or at least this first segment of the program today, is kind of like taking a breather. So, and I just want to remind the listeners, we have James Corbett interviewed by Dave, and they will be joining you for the second and third program. So we're live the first 20 minutes, and again, it's January 5th, 2018. I always want to make sure I say 18, because it's easy to slip back into that 2017 year.
We're leaning forward and looking forward.
Yes. Today, gold still strong at $1,320. It was down $3. Silver was down 5 cents at $1,725. Platinum, again, kind of went its own way to the upside today, up $6 at $973. And palladium was down $6 at $1,096. So not a bad day considering all else that is happening. And I do believe even we saw a little strength in the dollar, up 0.10 at $91.97. Crude oil was down 0.53 at $61.48. And the paper markets today, you know, it's 219 points. Almost makes me want
fantasy land, Melody. Fantasy land.
Yes. Hey, we can have our own Disneyland, you know, economics, paper markets. 25,295. The NASDAQ was up 58 points at 71.36, and the S&P was up 19 at 27.43. 10-year yield, 2.48%, you know, it climbed 0.02. European markets, were basically, you know, not a whole lot of action going on there. We seem to be gaining a little more greed on the emotion scale, the fear and greed index. And, of course, Bitcoin was up big today, 10%, back up over 16,000. So considering all those positive numbers and gold only being down 2 today, gold had a great day. It was really a good day. Yesterday, we talked about the ADP come out, and they released their number that there was going to be 250 some thousand jobs added in December. And I said on that program yesterday, well, they're usually wrong. And they were, and by a lot. But it didn't seem to matter. Everyone yesterday, it was really kind of funny, Dave. Yesterday, the big headline on all the financial programs or the news online websites had the big number, 250,000 jobs gained in December. Today, since it was revised with the government numbers, only 148, you can't find that number anywhere.
What do they attribute the difference to, Melody? Have you read or heard anything?
Well, ADP is always wrong. You know, they I can't remember the last time they were actually in line with the government numbers, but the government numbers today came out. Employers added 148,000 workers. Actually, the estimate by most of the economists were even stronger than that, 190,000. Now, the jobless rate did maintain at 4.1%. The biggest pullback in positions were retail. They lost. And we talked to that a little bit yesterday, losing in the month of December when you have a holiday buying or a holiday employment season.
Yeah. I see Macy's and Sears are closing more stores, it looks like.
Yes, yes, we talked about that yesterday. We had 30,000, there were solid gains in construction, 25,000 in manufacturing. Retailers cut a little over 20,000 positions during the height of the holiday shopping season, bringing total gains among service providers to 91,000, down from 176,000 in November. And And that's something we'll be talking about now, as they did release the number of retail stores will be over 12,000 next year. So we'll talk about that as the year goes on. There was another interesting report that I saw today, and global debt, a record $233 trillion in the third quarter of 2017. Now, you know, I guess nobody really pays attention to this anymore. I don't think it doesn't seem to matter anymore, Dave.
Yeah. Everett Dirksen used to say a billion here and a billion there, and sooner or later you're talking about real money. When is debt, this massive debt, real money? Something that we ought to be spending a lot more attention to.
Yeah, I mean, it's a billion here and a billion there, a million here, a trillion here, a trillion there.
Yeah, I know.
And it doesn't seem to make a difference in these economies. Now, the debt pileup could put a little bit of a brake on the central banks trying to raise interest rates, given worries that the debt servicing capacity of highly indebted firms and government, the higher those rates, it's going to be harder to service that debt. Mm-hmm. So, and again, you know, what would happen to these world economies if rates really begin to rise significantly? This debt would come to a halt. Central bankers could no longer continue to stimulate these economies to the degree that they are. So, $233 trillion. I guess that doesn't sound like a lot to a lot of people, but to me, it seems like an awful lot.
Yeah, I mean, on top of our almost $21 trillion federal government debt, the amount of personal debt amassed so far by just Americans alone. Do we know what portion of that consumer debt is to that 233?
This basically says, according to the analyst by the Institute of International Finance, private non-financial sector debt hit all-time highs.
Jeez.
It doesn't really, yeah. And that's in Canada, France, Hong Kong, South Korea, Switzerland, Turkey. So it's... to me, I think it's interesting, and it's just like, you know, they're just pumping until they can no longer pump into the system today.
Whew. Does it signal another perhaps international credit bubble?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the only thing that I know that will protect people's purchasing power is gold. Enjoy it while you can. And I mean, I think, and that's what I think people are doing. They're enjoying, you know, the pie in the sky scenario. And so we got a short 20-minute segment. Dave, do you have anything in particular in your mind today that you'd like to discuss?
Well, Melody, I mean, we'll talk with James Corbett and hear his perspectives on sort of a roundup of 2017 and a look ahead at some of the things on his mind in the coming year. Just wanted to alert listeners to one of the topics you and I are going to talk about next week. That being the start of a new year is always a good time to evaluate your investments. Melody, listeners are going to want to tune in for sure to hear financial planning experts and economists' insights on what they ought to be doing now to make sure they're poised to reap the financial gains that people like David Stockman say gold and silver investors in particular will benefit from in the coming year. Last week, the former Reagan White House budget director reminded us that the Fed is going to start normalizing and shrinking their balance sheet beginning later this year by at least $600 billion a year. What that means in plain English is that our Fed is going to be dumping $600 billion of existing U.S. treasuries into the market, just as the federal government will be attempting to borrow over $1 trillion more. Stockman says, if you don't think that's a financial collision waiting to happen, then I'm not sure what would be. He goes on to say, Melody, we're heading for a thundering collision in the bond market that will drive yields upward far more than the market's expecting. You mentioned the 10-year Treasury yield at 2.48, and most pundits agree that, you know, when we get to not much more than 3.4%, and some people are saying it could go as high as 4%, depending on what happens, what some of the central banks do, that's just prime territory for surging in gold and silver prices. Anyway, we know that the stock market operates in part on the illusion of permanently low interest rates. And when interest rates continue to rise this year, everything's likely to come apart because cheap debt has been priced into stocks forever. And we're heading for far more expensive debt, it looks like. Stockman believes that bond prices are going to collapse when yields begin to rise, and that stock prices will collapse big time when the underlying cheap debt and massive stock buybacks and these merger and acquisition deals and everything else supporting the market today finally reverses. He says, so we're going to have a deflation in the canyons of Wall Street, and that will not be a happy day. Stockman, like you and I believe, at that point, gold and silver is going to be the only safe investments left. So, Melody, we want listeners to make sure to tune in to Financial Survival next week, and certainly to pay close attention to interest rates over the next several months.
And you know what's always interesting is, you know, we've been talking, you know, anybody who knows anything, anybody who understands what real monetary policy is, gets that these bubbles in the bond market and all these, you know, the reasons that's pushing these stock markets worldwide to these records is cheap debt. Mm-hmm. And they all know it's going to stop. It is just truly a matter of time. There's been warnings, even from the elite, even from those who, you know, that created the problems to begin with, are coming mm-hmm. out and saying, hey, you know. And what scares me the most, Dave, and it doesn't scare me, but what amazes me the most, is that there's no reactions to anything. And I get it about algorithms and things like that aren't meant to trade with emotions and so forth, but there's still a driving factor. Emotions will still drive markets. You know, I mean, the algorithms don't overtake the emotions. And it surprises me. It doesn't matter what happens. It doesn't matter what anybody does. It doesn't matter what anybody says. It doesn't matter whatever the numbers say. It's like this euphoria that everything's just going to go higher and higher and higher and higher and higher.
Well, as someone once said, it's going to go higher until it doesn't. And at that point, who knows how suddenly and precipitously and how far that fall might be.
And I know everybody has their predictions when it's going to happen, how it's going to happen, and I think the psychology of people believing it's never going to fall. I mean, even the cryptocurrencies, you know, people are thinking they're buying in the cryptocurrencies that they're going to be able to sell their business and retire this year or next year because it's always going higher. Oh, it might correct down lower, but it's going to go higher.
Yeah.
It's like, really? I mean, it's just it's that mentality that tells me that we're close to a top. Because you get the last push of investors, you get that last push into these markets that will push it to these unreal numbers before it actually collapses. Always has, always will.
Friends, one of the lessons in all of this is do your research. In the trade, they call it due diligence. Don't trade just on a whim. Don't trade just because your friends are. I've got two friends, in fact, one of whom quit his job. Now, he's been underemployed for some time, and you know, it wasn't a great paying job. Nevertheless, he quit his job to invest his savings, and not a whole lot of savings, in cryptocurrency, not realizing that it's still pretty doggone hard to buy cryptocurrency. And he found that out the hard way. So here he is without a job, having a real heck of a time buying any substantial amount of whatever he's into, Bitcoin or Ethereum or whatever. And his, I believe I would count him among the people you mentioned, people who are hoping to make a quick buck and retire next year. It's not going to happen. Do your research. I mean, obviously, there's always some leap of faith. You're going to listen to a lot of different viewpoints out there, listeners. Listen to people you trust and then act on that based on your short and long-term needs.
Yeah, and also, I want to remind the listeners real quick, we're still carrying on that 1 ounce Silver Eagle special, 2018s, no shipping, 20 or more. We're still going to carry that. We've got great prices. I have a few 1 ounce silver rounds, so if you didn't want the Silver Eagles, I do have some great prices on 1 ounce silver rounds. They're the Buffaloes, so great price on those. 90% silver, heck, I mean, you can't. The premiums on silvers have dropped so much, particularly in the 90% silver. It's a great time to be picking that up. But you have to give us a call, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com, and make sure you sign up for the weekly newsletter. And, of course, you can listen to the programs are archived on a daily basis, so daily and longer term basis. We got just about a minute, and you had just wanted to mention a little bit about the dollar. We can continue this conversation on Monday also.
Well, you're right, Melody. We do know that 2017 wasn't a good year for the U.S. dollar. I mean, despite traders' optimism after Trump got elected and the Federal Reserve's best efforts over the last year, the dollar is at its lowest level in a decade. I mean, the stock market's at historical highs, but as 2017 ended, the dollar was down anywhere between 7 and 10% compared to other key currencies, depending on whose numbers you follow. Certainly weak inflation and doubts over the president's and Congress's ability to deliver on their legislative promises have contributed to the dollar's decline. Plus, with fairly strong economic growth and strict central bank policies across the globe, they've played a key role in the dollar's weakness as well, and further rate hikes by the Fed have looked powerless to stop it. Now, on the bright side, because of their unique seesaw relationship, the dollar's decline means good news for gold. When the dollar goes down, gold goes up. What does that mean, Melody?
They need to call Discount Gold and Silver. We're heading into a break. We can't finish it. Stay tuned, folks. James Corbett and Dave will be right back. Thank you very much for joining me.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE csctalkradio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Talking away, no, I don't know what to say or say it anyway. Today is another day.
And welcome back to Financial Survival. This is Dave Allen, your co-host, along with Melody Cederstrom. We're pleased to welcome back to the show Mr. James Corbett. As most listeners know, James is a regular guest on Financial Survival, scheduled to appear this year every other Friday. For newer listeners, James is editor, webmaster, writer, producer, and host of The Corbett Report. The Corbett Report is an independent, listener-supported alternative news source. It operates on the principle of open source intelligence and provides podcasts, interviews, articles, and videos about breaking news and important issues from 9/11 truth and false flag terror to the Big Brother police state, eugenics, geopolitics, the central banking fraud, and more. James, again, welcome and Happy New Year.
Well, Happy New Year to you, and it's good to be here. I'm looking forward to this new year of new programs.
Terrific. This is our first time on air together. I'm also looking forward to hearing your thoughts and insights. Before I get to some questions, I'd like to ask you, is there anything on your mind that you'd like to start off this segment in the new year talking about?
There are so many, many things that are on my mind at all times, but I suppose something that's really been sticking out to me the last few weeks that I've written about in the International Forecaster, the last couple of issues, and that I'll probably be writing about again in the near future, is the technocratic stories that are flooding the news feeds right now, and not just here in the Asia Pacific, although certainly there are those as well. For example, China just announcing a £1.5 billion, I guess that would be about $2.5 billion artificial intelligence park that they're going to be opening up, I believe, in Beijing, to research artificial intelligence. But stories like that have just been really hitting the news feeds very hard in the last few weeks specifically, and I think that's just something to be keeping our eye on. I think obviously the tech sector has been dominating for a while, but is going to be even more so in the new year.
Following up on a prediction you made for 2017, I believe you wrote the other week in an article called 2017, the Year of Technocracy Confirmed, that the PR campaign for technocracy is kicked into full swing, and that the worst part of that is that the vast majority of the public is going to support such a world. Can you tell our listeners about that prediction, James, what technocracy looks like and how the public is being conditioned to accept the so-called Brave New World's technocrats?
Right. Well, this stems back to the prediction that I made at the beginning of 2017. My first editorial of the year was about the 2017, the year of technocracy, where I boldly predicted that 2017 would be something of an inflection point. And obviously, not that there's any suddenly new phenomenon that suddenly takes place that would change anything, but just that the trend that we've seen towards the automation of so many jobs in various sectors and the development of artificial intelligence and the widespread adoption of technologies like Alexa and Google Echo or Google Home or whatever they're calling it, these types of technologies is going to be making more and more of a difference in our life. And technically speaking, technocracy does not necessarily refer to technology per se. It's about the rule of a engineer or expert class of some sort. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't necessarily mean technology itself, but I think that is the way that it is taking shape right now. And it is defining more and more of our lives in ways that are not so subtle anymore. Things that sounded sci-fi, fantasy, and bizarre in the past now sound almost, well, these are just the daily headlines. headlines, and the one that I just tweeted out just before I went on air here, Nissan's car of the future will decode your brainwaves to make you a better driver, where they're talking about wearing these skull caps with these electromagnetic implants to basically read your brain so that it can the automatic driving can adjust to your driving habits.
Wow.
These types of stories are just happening so frequently and so it's just becoming part of the daily news feed that I think blinking you'll miss it. There really is a changeover that's taking place right now, and I think that's manifested in a way that, again, on the day-to-day level, we might not experience it so directly, but when we look at even just a few years out in the future, we can definitely see how transformative this is going to be for our entire society. And I think of that as a parent here with my 4-year-old son here in Japan, and I've talked to him many times about, oh, you know, you like the trucks? You want to drive a truck when you're older? I don't know if that's going to be a job when you're older. It's the type of thing where I don't know where this is going. And I'd like to be positive and hopeful about it, but there are so many ways, so many different pitfalls that we could fall into if we stumble into this technocratic vision of the future subconsciously or unconsciously.
Yeah. You know, and here I grew up thinking the life of my children was going to be a simple Jetson-esque existence. It seems as though, one, we're getting there probably much sooner than those cartoon writers ever envisioned, and two, it might not be as friendly as we had hoped.
Well, actually, I mean, it's interesting that you bring that up, because I heard an interesting observation recently about the Jetsons. And if you go back and watch it, which I haven't done since I was a kid, but if you go back and watch it now, you'll notice that not only they have the, you know, the flying cars and live in the cities in the sky and all of that kind of futuristic stuff and the robot maid and all of that, but also when the kids, for example, bring home a note from the teacher, it's written on paper, which is an interesting thing when you think about it, because, of course, yes, someone from the 1960s or whenever trying to envision what the future would look like, they can think of certain developments of technology, but other developments just don't really hit you. So the idea that, you don't write notes on paper to bring home with you, you'd have email, right? Those types of disruptive technologies are so fundamentally disruptive that we can't even envision that in the future. So when we cast our mind out, even 10 years, let alone 20, 30, 40, 50 years, we're probably making we are undoubtedly making those same mistakes, not seeing the disruptive technologies that are going to come along and change our entire perception of how things will be done. So, you know, we have so many different hurdles to cross here, including the hurdle that we can't even possibly predict what's coming along the line a few years from now.
Yeah, so there's hope that number two pencils and big pens may be a part of our future.
You never know.
You never know. So when will Siri say no? When do you think we're going to have robots that think independently and instead of following just orders can make up their own mind?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. And obviously, I think most people envision that in the sense of the Skynet gaining self-awareness and taking control of the Earth type of scenario, which,
indeed,
I mean, again, doesn't even sound so outlandish as it would have sounded even a couple of decades ago. But beyond that, there's also the question of the things that are the decisions that are being made right now, politically and economically, that are going to shape the way this future unfolds. And one example that I like to point out from several years ago, back in 2009, when we're still dealing with the fallout of the housing crisis, and there was the emergency funding and spending that was coming about, and the government programs to kickstart the economy that came with certain interesting strings attached, and it was largely geared towards moving towards this green future that we're being promised of environmentally friendly technologies that come with interesting stipulations, like the idea that it was actually wedded into California law, and I'm not sure about other states. I'm assuming that it probably has been passed in other states by this point, but the idea that the electricity companies or the government will be able to mandate companies to regulate even such things as the temperature that you set your house at with your thermostat.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's the type of thing where a generation ago, that wouldn't have even been imaginable. Mm-hmm. I have my Switch here in my home. How are you going to change that? Well, now that we have these smart homes of the future and Siri controlling everything, or Alexa, or whoever it is that you allow into your home, controlling all of your smart devices, that's a very real thing in which that can actually take place. And obviously, we're not seeing it to that extent at this point, where government is mandating that you must keep your air conditioner at such and such a level, but we can certainly see how that will be possible in the future, and this is the likely direction that things are going in. So the question of when the machines start saying no, or perhaps more accurately, when the government starts telling the machines to start saying no, is a real, it's a real question. And that's one of the things that I think we have to be aware of as we stumble into this technocratic future.
Do you view such an evolution or change as a slippery slope into a world that isn't necessarily desirable, or is it just a necessity, for lack of a better word, that we, I guess, collectively as a society or country or what have you, decide that, well, this is in our own best interests and our own collective interests. This is something we need to live with.
Well, I don't know if necessity is quite the right word for it, but there is a certain inevitability to all of this, isn't there? There's no way that people are going to simply stop researching technological innovation because they think it might be going in a bad direction. That seems to be the least likely of all possibilities. And it's not even necessarily the case that even people who are concerned about this technologies would necessarily want all technological innovation to cease. No, of course, there is a genuine benefit that these technologies can and do bring. And without that, we wouldn't see people clamoring for these technologies quite as much as we do. But it's always the flip side, the dark shadow of those promises and those wonderful things that these bring. It's, well, yes, and they'll come piggybacked with NSA backdoor surveillance or whatever it is. And that's always the flip side of these types of deals that we make with the devil when we're dealing with these technologies. And I'm not sure there isn't an easy answer to that. As I say, it's not that, even if we wanted to, it's not as if we could flip a switch and stop people from developing these technologies. Mm-hmm. I think perhaps the more important thing is people's mindset and consciousness about these technologies and the ways that they're being used and how invasive this really is. To me, sitting here from my perspective, here in Japan, watching a lot of these developments taking place from a distance, as it were, to me, it's quite... I experience when I see the rollout of the Alexas and the Google Homes and all of these things, when I see the rollout of these technologies, and I see it as the kind of creepy Orwellian technology that I think people would have seen that if they had been introduced to this suddenly 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 years ago. But as it's happening bit by bit, and oh, your friend got an Alexa, and so you play with it a little bit, and oh, okay, I'll get one for my home. Mm-hmm. I think it rolls out in such a way that it's just a gradual turning up of the boiling pot, as it were, and the frogs aren't going to jump out of that. So, again, I'm not sure what the point of this or what the real response to this can or should be, other than to denormalize these technologies that are starting to profoundly change the way that we live our lives without us necessarily knowing about it. I don't have any solutions to the way this is going, but I think at the very least, I would just like people to more consciously think about the types of technologies they are allowing into their own homes to see and listen to everything they're doing, and to really make that calculation on a conscious basis, whether or not this is really worth what they are getting out of the deal.
Well, your insights on this are very important and much appreciated, James. Are you ready to share any predictions for 2018?
As a matter of fact, yes. Well, obviously, that's going to be my first editorial of the year.
I don't want to get you in trouble with your publisher. Oh, no, wait, that's you.
Exactly right. Well, I will spill the beans to let you know that it's not going to be a very serious prediction editorial, precisely because I think I see the futility and the silliness of the kind of prediction exercise in general, let alone these kind of, you know, prediction articles that we're flooded with at the beginning of each year. But if I was talking seriously for a moment, I think clearly, again, I'm biased being here in the Asia-Pacific region, but I think the developments here with regards to the North Korea situation, with regards to the rise of the Chinese economy, with regards to the rebirth, perhaps, of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And these types of issues, I think, are going to be certainly dominating my newsfeed over the course of the next year, and I imagine having more relevance to people in the U.S. and elsewhere.
Let's hope so. And with the few minutes we have before our first break, I want to just continue a little more on the subject of technology. As many listeners have now read or heard about, in a victory primarily for internet service providers like AT&T, Comcast, and Verizon, the Federal Communications Commission voted last week to repeal these so-called net neutrality rules. FCC Commissioner Ajit Pai, who was appointed by President Trump, forged ahead with the vote of his commission despite widespread opposition and a request from 18 state attorneys general to delay it over concerns that the public comment process was corrupted by fraudulent messages. The repeal proposal passed on 3-2 on party lines. The repeal, as you know, James, rolls back the so-called Title II regulations that were implemented by the Obama administration that classified the internet as a public utility, and which, among other things, required internet service providers, or ISPs, to treat all the data traveling on their networks equally. Now, without these protections, these Title II protections, those ISPs can now legally, at least theoretically, begin treating data from some websites differently than others. Will they? Do you think they will, James? Will they charge customers differently for access to competitors' websites, for example, or pay or make you pay for higher internet speed?
Well, I suppose the question is, were they doing this before 2015, which is when the Title II regulation came in? If you can remember back to those days of 2014, if you can remember what internet service was like back then, well, hey, that's what we have today, isn't it? Or at least that's what you have in the United States. I think there's grave ideological mistakes that are being made here by well-meaning people on the internet who believe that they are fighting for the freedom of the internet, but are really clamoring for government regulation, which I don't think there is a problem for which the solution is more governments meddling. And I think there are, again, drastic implications for giving over the reins, as it were, to the U.S. government or any other government to regulate the ways that networks should be functioning. And I've talked about this in some degree of detail. I know we're running up against the break, so maybe I can't break it down completely. But personally, I think a lot of people are maybe putting the wrong emphasis on the way that this is going and are seeing this for a greater danger than it really is.
Oh, well, let's stop there, and we'll take the conversation back up on the other side of the break.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen, here with my co-host Melody Cederstrom. We've got James Corbett of the Corbett Report with us today. We were talking in the last segment about the FCC decision to end so-called net neutrality. Before we get back to James, I just want to follow up that ahead of last week's vote, Michael Powell, who heads the National Cable and Telecommunications Association and is a former FCC chair, argued that just because it's now legal for these internet service providers to discriminate against internet traffic and create fast lanes doesn't mean they will, although Powell didn't say they wouldn't either. Interesting, just last week also, Comcast quietly changed the net neutrality pledge that had been on its website since 2014 by removing a promise that it wouldn't prioritize internet traffic or create paid fast lanes, and replacing it with a much more cautious pledge to, quote, not block, throttle, or discriminate against lawful content. So if Comcast decides on a whim to change its pledge again next week or the week after, it absolutely can. James, what are your thoughts? You were in the middle of a thought when we went to a break. What do you think about this?
Well, again, I think that there are genuine concerns that people have and probably should have about the amount of control that companies like Comcast or what have you have over their internet access, the way things stand now. And unfortunately, when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So if all you have is the hammer of government intervention, then every problem looks like, oh, well, we can hammer that down with that hammer. But that is not necessarily, and I would say is necessarily not, the best way to handle these situations. So there are a number of different ideological points to be made here, one of which is the entire idea of Title II and public utility legislation and generally the granting of monopoly status by government entities to special and privileged industries, which is essentially what we're talking about here. It's the government coming in and saying, this industry is so important and so difficult to do or what have you, that this company is going to basically be a monopoly, and that will make everything better. That, in fact, does not make everything better, as has been proven time and again throughout history. And as examples of that, I mean, just look at the old Ma Bell monopoly that was the standard of the telecommunications industry from its inception in the early 20th century, and how that actually inhibited communication process for decades and decades and decades until disruptive technologies like the internet came along that were outside of the control of that that monopoly granted industry and utterly transformed our idea of communication, so that apparently now all you have to do to make a local telephone call is to ask, you know, your Alexa or your Siri to dial a certain number, and you can get dialed through on the internet for free, local calls anywhere in North America. Imagine explaining that to someone even a few decades ago in the United States. It would be, well, how is that possible even? That doesn't make any sense. So, again, I think holding back innovation is actually one of the unintended consequences, or perhaps even intended consequences, of these types of public utility legislations, because I think another important point to be made here is that large companies, the big monopoly-type companies, love to be made into monopolies. Of course, they do not want competition. So if the government can step in and say, you're now a privileged class and no one can compete with you, hey, isn't that a great position to be in if you are that large company? So that's one of the things that I think people fundamentally don't understand about these situations. Whether it was the formation of the FDA back in the original legislation back in 1907, where they started to put in the Food and Standards Act, or whatever it was called at the time, as a result of the outcry over the meatpacking industry and the way that it was handling or mishandling meat products and all of that, caused by the fury over reporting by reporting in quotation marks novels by Upton Sinclair about the jungle. And the ultimate effect of that was that, of course, the large meatpackers got behind that legislation. They actually helped to pass that legislation because, again, it made it erected barriers to competitors to come into the market and actually compete with the large meatpackers. So we have to be very critical and quizzical when we see people arguing that government regulation and making these Comcast and others into virtual monopolies is the way forward, is the way to actually progress in terms of development of internet networks. Another point to be made here is that, again, like the Jetsons, imagining that we're going to be writing notes on paper, you know, 50 years from now, we cannot possibly imagine the ways that the internet delivery is going to truly transform and revolutionize in even the coming years, let alone the coming decades. Mm-hmm. And we're already looking at mesh networking technologies and other things that will fundamentally change the way, or SAT cubes. There are lots of really innovative things that are coming online that are going to fundamentally change and fundamentally bust up these monopolies or virtual monopolies that exist now to these big companies, these cable companies and others that have basically started to become the internet monopolists. There are going to be very disruptive technologies that are going to take that, yank that out from under them. The only thing that would stop them is if the government says, no, you can't run, you know, your SatCube internet network, because that would be against our public utility legislation. So that's another thing.
Yeah.
And another thing that people probably don't think about is whenever you give the government the power to do something, even something you want, so even if you want to give the government the power to say, okay, we can come in and legislate that all internet providers have to do treat the network this way, yay, great, okay, so we'll all get data at the same rates and everything.
Sure.
But that is also thereby handing the power to that government in perpetuity to come in and change those rules any way they like, to anything they like, at any point in the future. And you might want to ask people living in slightly more overtly dictatorial societies how they feel about the government having the power to regulate what internet service providers can and cannot do. It does not take a great deal of imagination to imagine, if you're a liberal and you think Trump is the Antichrist and you think he's, you know, the worst thing ever, then you don't want to give that kind of power to someone like Trump. And if you're a conservative and you think Obama or Hillary or whoever else is the Antichrist and you don't want to give them the power, then you can at least imagine why it might not be a good idea to hand that type of power over to the government. Just imagine that power being in the hands of your worst enemy and then thinking about what they might do with that power. Is, again, something that people don't tend to think about when they're arguing for these issues. As long as they perceive that, at least at this precise moment, this government is doing what we want, there seems to be a mental block on people imagining that that power might be used in a way they don't want in the future.
Well, those are fascinating thoughts, James. Certainly important for listeners to consider. Thank you for that. If you don't mind, I wouldn't mind taking a lighter take the rest of this segment. The Eurasia Group, one of probably not among your favorite folks, but the Eurasia Group listed their top 10 risks report for 2018, released this week by Eurasia President Ian Bremmer and their chair, Cliff Kupchan. The big picture, they say, 2018 doesn't feel too good. Markets are soaring and the economy isn't bad, but citizens everywhere are divided. National governments aren't doing much governing. and the global order is essentially unraveling. Now, they say this is important because in the 20 years since they've started the Eurasia Group, if they had to pick one year for a big unexpected crisis, it feels like 2018. Now, James, if you don't mind, I'd like to name the top 10 risks that are worrying Bremer and his colleagues. And after I read each risk, tell listeners, say real if the issue is really worth worrying about in your mind, or say mirage or unreal if the issue isn't worth losing sleep over. All right with you?
That sounds good. Let's do it.
All right. Well, number one, falls into the general area that we talked about a little bit earlier. China loves a vacuum. China setting international standards on trade, investment, tech values, and security with less resistance than ever before. James?
Real, with an asterisk to say that it's a manipulated event, but I think it is, at any rate, manifesting in reality.
Oh, good. Two, accidents. Of course, it's impossible to ignore the risk of a major crisis today, because there are just too many places where a misstep or misjudgment could provoke serious international conflict.
Yes, again, I think that is a real threat, as it always is, I suppose, but there are certainly a lot of flashpoints where something could go drastically wrong very quickly, so I think we have to be at least aware of that.
Yeah, three, global tech Cold War. They say achieving dominance in emerging technologies is the world's most important battle for economic power. Russia seems to have gotten that a long time ago, China as well.
Absolutely, yes, and that's very real. And in fact, we could just turn back to last year when Putin said that whoever develops artificial intelligence first is going to be the leader of the world. Mm-hmm. And I think he's not wrong about that.
Number four, Mexico. This year will be a defining moment for Mexico's longer-term outlook, which will depend on the outcome of NAFTA renegotiation and the country's presidential election this July 1st.
Potentially real, I suppose. I don't know if that's very enthusiastic, but yeah, I guess it could be a divining error. It could also not be.
Yeah. U.S.-Iran relations. If the nuclear agreement fails, the world will enter a new and dangerous dynamic.
Oh, absolutely, yes. And I think instead of fails, we should use the word is undermined. But at any rate, that's clearly on the cards, and clearly with the unrest we've seen over the past week, I think that's just a taste of what's to come.
Thank you for distinguishing that. We'll come back to Iran and recent protests in a few minutes if we have any time left. The erosion of institutions. Across the developed world, popular trust in bureaucratic institutions has declined steeply, in some instances as a result of direct political interference in their work.
Yes, well, I suppose that's a real phenomenon, but I don't think it's a problem. In fact, I think that's potentially a good thing, but at any rate, it is something that's happening.
Indeed. Protectionism 2.0. Anti-establishment movements have forced policymakers to shift toward a more mercantilist approach to global economic competition.
Yes, well, yes, it's a real thing. I think it could go either way in terms of there are good things to be had from that, like the scuttling of quote-unquote free trade deals like TPP, which are not free trade at all, but carefully restricted and controlled and managed trade for the benefit of crony corporations. But it can also go the other way, where countries really do start shutting down borders to trade, and that generally isn't a good thing, and is, in fact, generally a presage of war.
Well, let's segue then to the next one, which is the United Kingdom. The UK's troubles will come from both acrimonious Brexit negotiations and difficult domestic politics.
Yeah, okay, I suppose that is real. Certainly, there has been a lot of disruption in the UK politically over the last few years, and I don't see that dying off anytime soon, so it will be a politically interesting year, at any rate.
Indeed. Two more to go. Identity politics in Southern Asia. Southern Asia identity politics threatens the future of these increasingly prosperous regions, creating unexpected challenges for economic planners and foreign investors.
I've never thought of it in those terms, and I realize they're talking about Islam and nationalism and things like that. That's not the way I would frame the issue, and I don't think it's going to be any particularly different this year than any other year.
Okay. End it with Africa's security. Negative spillover from Africa's unstable periphery will increasingly spoil the continent's success stories.
I'd be interested to hear about those success stories, because they are few and far between on the African continent. I do think that long term, looking out five years or even a decade, clearly Africa is going to be an extremely important part of the kind of proxy struggle, geopolitical and economic, between the U.S. and China.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it has those flashpoints. It also has, of course, ISIS, Boko Haram, whatever, you know, the Al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula, and those types of groups operating in various parts of northeastern Africa that are clearly still going to be, I think, important in the coming year. At any rate, there's a lot of things developing in Africa, and African security certainly will be, if not this year, at least going forward, is going to be more of an issue than it has in previous years.
Well, speaking of Africa, I read a recent story in Time magazine which talked about the major influx of U.S. special forces all over the world. A little noticed build-up in Niger, for example, is just a snapshot of the expanding worldwide deployment of 8,000-plus U.S. Commandos sort of speaks perhaps to at least our country's perception of the importance of certain countries in Africa. Well, it sounds like we might be out of time for today's show. James Corbett, we've so appreciated having you back. Happy New Year to you. We'll see you in a couple of weeks. Listeners,
Happy New Year to you.
Thank you so much. Listeners, thank you for tuning in. We appreciate your listenership, and we'll see you next time on Financial Survival Radio. Have a great weekend, everybody. I told her.